Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour we talk about the extraordinary play, The Mountaintop, which is currently being performed at the Semke Theater by the Milwaukee Rep. A little background is in order before we meet both the playwright and the director of the Milwaukee Rep's version of The Mountaintop. On April 3rd of 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King checked into a room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. This article was written recently in The New Yorker about this night. It was a room that he and Ralph Abernathy stayed in so often that the owners called it the King Abernathy Suite. King was to speak at Mason Temple Golden, and he nearly didn't make it there because he was tired. He was fighting a cold, guessing that a horrible storm would keep people home, and he asked Abernathy to go in his place. When Abernathy arrived, he found that there were some 3,000 fired up citizens, so King decided to go, and he gave such a haunting and beautiful and stirring speech. Here is part of it.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The day after that speech, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. The Mountaintop is a play about what happens after Dr. Martin Luther King retires to his room in the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. A beautiful young hotel maid comes in, and she is awed by Dr. King's fame as he is awed by her beauty. He later becomes awed by what she has to say as well. It is a very, very moving performance, and we are delighted this hour of the program to have the director of the Milwaukee Rep, The Mountaintop, and the playwright. Katori Hall is with us. Her play won the 2010 Olivier Award for Best New Play. It ran recently on Broadway. She's written many other plays, and her journalism has appeared in the New York Times, Boston Globe, Essence, many other publications. She's an alumna of the Lark Playwrights Workshop, where she developed The Mountaintop. She's a graduate of Columbia University and the Juilliard School. And Katori, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. May Andrales is also with us. May is Artistic Associate Director at the Milwaukee Rep, and she is Director of The Mountaintop. She also recently directed Yellow Man. She has worked at theaters all over the country, the Goodman in Chicago, New York Theater Workshop, and she is on faculty at the Yale School of Drama. May, thank you so much for being with us. Are you there, May?
Yes, thank you.
There we go. Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us. Katori, why don't you give us the backstory of the play, because it is absolutely fascinating, and it concerns your mother.
Yeah, it's interesting. When people ask me, oh, you're so young, you weren't even alive when King was here, like, why did you write this play? And it's really because my mother had this deep personal connection to this moment in history. My mother grew up in Memphis around the corner from the Lorraine Motel, and she was just very inspired by Dr. King, as so many people in the community were, and she wanted to participate in the marches, and, you know, she wanted to carry her I Am a Man sign, you know, in support of the sanitation worker strike. And so when King came to speak in support of that on April 3rd, she really wanted to go. And Mason Temple, you know, it was in walking distance, the church that he was going to go speak at, and she was like, I have to go. I have to go hear him speak. I've seen like a sliver of his face before, you know, in the previous march, but I've never heard him speak, so I have to go. And she was 15 years old at the time. So she asked her mother, my grandmother, you know, can I go hear Dr. King speak? And Big Mama was like, you need to sit your little butt down. You know they're going to bomb their church. Somebody is out to get that man. And so my mother, who was the mother of two young girls at the time, you know, she thought about her life. She thought about this kind of ominous rumor that was circulating around the community, and she decided to heed her mother's advice, and she did not go. And so she never got a chance to hear Dr. King speak, and as history unfolded the next day, he was assassinated. And that moment, you know, it was the biggest regret of her life, the fact that she didn't take that opportunity to sneak out of the house and go hear this amazing oratory. Mm.
Was she haunted? If you said that you lived around the corner from the Lorraine Motel, was she haunted by that motel, and were you, and are you still?
I definitely think she was haunted by the motel, just because, you know, she really was into around the corner, you know, the day of the assassination. You know, she was with a woman who was driving down the street, and they saw all these police cars going towards the Lorraine Motel, and the woman that she was driving with broke down crying, and she said they killed Dr. King. She killed Dr. King without even knowing that, you know, Dr. King had been shot. And so this woman turned around and followed the police, and that feeling, that premonition, obviously, they confronted it. And so I feel as though, because she was, you know, within stone's throw of history, she really always thought about it, was so close to it, and she told me the story over and over and over again. She probably told it to me when I was 5, but I started remembering it when I was 10, because it was just so striking. And around that age, you're beginning to understand history and understand context.
Yes.
And it was interesting to see how history was not, you know, so far away from us. The fact that I actually had like a first person account of this moment, this huge event in American history, was very, very important to me, and it kind of showed me how we are all intrinsically linked to our past. Go ahead.
When, Katori, did you decide there was a play here?
I knew that there was a story, obviously, from the very first moment my mother told me it. But in terms of a play, probably 2007, I began to think about, oh, what if I put Dr. King in the room right after the mountaintop speech? What if this young woman, inspired by my mother, came to visit him in the form of a maid? What if? And
yes,
my imagination just went wild.
And the production may really capture so completely the thunderstorm, the ominous night, you know what's going to happen. You keep thinking, you hope that it's not going to happen, but it's all contained. The staging is very unusual, very dramatic, and the rain is incessant, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We wanted to give the feeling that the audience was in the room with King, and so where we have situated the audience is that they're in room 307 and also 305. So we set the stage in the middle of the theater, just to give that sense of that they're right there with him, that they have the experience of Camé, of also experiencing that last night with King.
Did it take, how do you decide to do a play like that? Because it would seem to me as though it adds a level of difficulty to it, doesn't it, to make sure that everybody can see, because it's such an intense drama that everybody can see everything.
Well, I think that I was at the Lark when Katori brought her, you know, some of the first pages of the first draft, the Lark Play Development Center in New York. And I remember when they did the first workshop production, it was in a very small room. And I think I was only, you know, 5 feet away from the two actors playing the two characters. And that was the first time I heard and saw that play loud. And it made such an impact on me. And I knew that there was something in the intimacy of being close to them that I wanted to capture in the production. So that's how I came
yes.
to that staging. And even though, you know, not everyone can see their faces all the time because it's in a tennis court, you know, seating arrangement, I feel like they feel the energy of those two actors, and they feel the emotion and what they're going through throughout the entire piece.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you did that brilliantly. It was brilliantly staged. I must say, Katori, and it's a credit to your writing, too. I saw that play, and I was alive when King was assassinated and had admired him so much, and there was so much dread that whole decade. But I woke up after I saw the play at 4:30 in the morning, and I was on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, and I was trying to keep Dr. King from coming out to the balcony. And I woke up in this sweat, and I just couldn't go back to sleep. So your play, I'm sure not, I'm not the only one, it really entered my heart and my soul very deeply.
Mm. Well, I have to thank May for bringing the production and these words to Milwaukee Rep, because she's just an amazing director. Hi, May. I haven't got a chance to say hi to her.
There we go.
Hi, May. So, and I love May, and I just feel so honored that she took it on. And I'm very excited to go see the production. I'm going to try and go next week before it closes. Just so I can see the work, and I know the actors, Nakia Mathis and J. Bernard Calloway, and they're just so amazing. So I'm so excited to see the production.
Mm-hmm. And it runs how long, May?
It runs until November 4th.
And one of the ideas was to show, I'm sure, Katori, Dr. Martin Luther King, as a full human being, that we have tended in the years since his death to idolize him. Certainly he is a martyr, but we've made him out to be this superhuman man.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You know, you walk into my grandmother's house and there's only one picture on the wall. It is Dr. King. I even feel like she probably took the picture of Jesus down recently. It's just Dr. King now. And so this idea that we as Americans have put him on a pedestal is something that I really grew up with. And I always, because I'm a playwright and I'm interested in putting human beings on stage and not necessarily ideas, I was always imagining, like, who was he behind the scenes? Who was he when he was with his friends? Did they joke around a lot? Did they? How was he when he spoke to his daughter on the phone? Like, all of these questions kind of haunted me, and it allowed an imaginative space for me to really play around with this idea of a man who had big dreams, extremely intelligent, a transformer of the world, but also a man who, you know, smoked cigarettes and, you know, had stinky marching feet, you know, when he got off the plane, and also dealt very, confronted his fear of death on a daily basis. And I think that confrontation is something that we as human beings can all relate to. Like, do we feel as though we have finished all of the things that we set out to do in our lives before, you know, the veil tolls? And I think that's really what pushes King throughout this piece of, I need to finish what I started.
Mm-hmm.
I am the head of this movement. What is going to happen without me? And the fact that over the course of the play, he actually accepts his death and embraces it. It's almost like a Garden of Gethsemane moment when he's kind of, you know, really fighting with his ideas, with spirituality, with God.
Did you feel that you were stepping on sacred ground here and thought that perhaps your play might raise some eyebrows? People would say, how could you make Dr. King human? Did you get that kind of response?
Oh, from everyone, from his family members, from the theater community, from people who marched with him, from my own father.
Oh, my.
I think it had a lot to do with either naivete or bravery or a mixture of both. I think it had a lot to do with me being so far removed from it, but still being super close. The fact that I grew up in Memphis myself, and, you know, that was the place where he left this earth, and always, you know, feeling like Memphis was responsible in a weird way for his death. And so because I'm a post-civil rights movement baby, you know, I just think it allowed me a historical distance that I could even approach the subject matter and the play and the characters with humor, even in some moments of the piece, which a lot of people were annoyed with. Like, how can this play be funny? How can a play about death be funny? You know, in some moments. And then the fact that, you know, you have him flirting with this hotel maid. It's like, my father didn't do that, you know. It's those kinds of things were told to me, but I just felt like, once again, I am a playwright. I'm not a historian. I'm not a politician. I'm a playwright, and it's about, you know, how can we get to the emotional truth of a human being, not an icon? How can we get to the emotional truth of an entire movement? And I really feel as though I really aimed to do that, because that's what a dramatist does. It gets us, you know, on the inside of humanity and inside of people's hearts and brain. It's not a replication of history. And I think anyone who goes to the play expecting, like, this historical account, you know, they may be disappointed, but I feel like a person who is interested in getting at the emotional truth of what this man was dealing with at that moment in time will be very satisfied.
And what about audience response, May? Have you had audience response that's been all over with this, some critical, some not? What kind of response?
You know, the first preview that we had, the tech team and I were, you know, talking in the back of the theater about things we needed to adjust. And this woman came up to me very slowly and just looked at me in the face, and she just said, "Thank you so much. This has meant so much to me. I have been transformed. Thank you." And she was so, she was just almost shaking with emotion, and that meant so much to me because it gave such validity to the work that Katori did on this play and what the design team and I had put together. But she was shaken, and of course I started crying too, so we had that moment. And, you know, the audience response is funny. Some audiences don't know when, if they should laugh. And some are just shocked at some of the things that come out of these two characters' mouths. You know, it's not the king that's in the history books, you know, that they're seeing. But I think what, you know, Katori does in the play, and what she's talked about, is that he is a man, and what they're witnessing is the power that a man or woman can have, you know, to change the world. And I think that's where the beauty lies. So I think you know, the audience response has been overwhelming. You know, I'm grateful to the Milwaukee community. You know, they've really embraced the play.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And it's obvious on both your parts, in terms of the production that you've done and the very effective use of the screens with the historical montage that comes at the end, which is very moving, I must say. It's very, very nicely done. And with all the references to the marches that were taking place in Memphis and to what was happening in Memphis, and it's obvious that you both have done a great deal of historical research just to have this in mind when you wrote the play and when you directed the play. Is that right, Katori?
Oh, in terms of historical perspective?
Yeah, in terms of knowing Dr. King, knowing the historical perspective in addition to the emotional perspective.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel as though I've been researching this my whole life, in a way, by growing up where I grew up, and the fact that I started going to the Lorraine Motel very, very early, and then it was transformed into an actual museum where you could see his actual room, 306, preserved in its final state, where you saw, you know, the overturned cups of coffee, the cigarettes, the unmade bed, the sheets, those things were very tactile for me because of the museum, but I also was able to go to the King Center down in Atlanta. I was also able to speak with Ambassador Andrew Young about his relationship with Dr. King, and you know, he actually read the play, and he actually was like, why do you have no cigarettes? Why can't he be eating catfish? Because that's what he really would have been doing, is eating catfish. But he also, which I thought was really funny, I was like, I don't think, Ambassador Young, I don't think I can put that in right now, but thank you for the suggestion. However, what he did say was this idea of him as a human being, and how close he was to him. He really felt that was something very evident in the play, and he really, really appreciated it. And I felt very blessed to have had the opportunity to speak with someone who actually, you know, by name pops up in the play, and to, you know, actually make him a real person for me. It's so interesting how all this history is right around us, and that we are very scared to look at the private king. But I feel as though this has been an opportunity to really delve into that untouched place, and maybe other people will follow suit.
Mm-hmm. And what about your historical research, May?
The set designer Lee Savage and I went to Memphis.
And oh, you did?
Yes, we went to Lorraine Motel, and we went to Mason Temple, and, you know, just spent a lot of time walking around that space. And I love the pre-production of research, so I threw myself into every biography, biography and article and civil rights books that I could, just to understand the given circumstances of this man and also the time period. So I had a very trustworthy script, you know, knowing Katori's thorough research herself, and I know that she's has a journalist background, that
yes,
that we were in good hands with the text. It was an honor, really, just to have the time and space to learn about this man. You know, he was extraordinary. He changed the way he changed the nature of citizenship unlike anybody else in American history.
Oh, what do you mean by that? That's interesting.
I think he recognized that personal power in a way that was inspiring and galvanized masses of people all over the world. And he did that with nonviolent measures in a time when the country was horrifically divided. And he was constantly searching for, he was constantly a student, and he was learning and being inspired by others, even to late in his life. I mean, he was just always on the search of how to find equality in the United States. And he did that in such a simple way, fighting for the right to vote, you know, fighting for people to stay to stay at a lunch counter,
right?
You know, mm-hmm. and those are small things, but they really change the way that we can view our role as citizens mm-hmm. in the world.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. I'm interested in hearing from some of you who I'm sure some of you have read the play. And some of you have had a chance to see the play as well, because it opened at the Milwaukee Rep, the Stemke Theater, on September 26th, and it runs, it opened on September 28th. Well, that's in the past anyhow, but it runs through November 4, and it's definitely worth seeing. We do have a little note, though. If you have seen it and you want to call in, we ask that you keep the plot twist to yourselves, because it would change the way you would see this play. So if you're going into the play not having read it, it's best to not know the plot twist. So if you can work around that in your comments. Here's our phone number for you to join our conversation with Katori Hall, playwright, performer, author of The Mountaintop, which is now on stage at the Stemke Theater in Milwaukee. May Andrales is artistic associate at the Milwaukee Rep and director of The Mountaintop. If you have not seen the play yet, what do you think of the idea of humanizing Dr. Martin Luther King? We can certainly talk about him and if we have made him to be too much a saint rather than being a human being. I thought that his changing the nature of citizenship were very interesting comments as well. And then the broader question of that was a long time ago. What about since then? Have we moved ahead or not? Join us, won't you? 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Or you can leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls. Our number, again, 800-486-8655. We're talking about The Mountaintop, which is worthy of a good, deep conversation. It is at the Milwaukee Rep Stemke Theater, and we're talking with the playwright, Katori Hall. The play has also been on Broadway, and May Andrales, who is director of the play. 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation and our conversation about Dr. Martin Luther King as well. So let's just spend a moment before we go to phone calls, which are coming in large numbers right now, talking about since the assassination. And I'm interested in both of your perspectives. Are you depressed about progress we've made? Have we made any progress in putting together that collage at the end of all the historical events? May, I'm sure that you thought about this long and hard.
Yeah. Obviously, I think it's both. In terms of that point in history, you know, April 4th, 1968, I feel as though for a lot of people, the world ended. My mother got so angry about where the world was, and like so many people, and I feel as though they didn't even see the possibility of progress because they just felt like something, a man that was almost an angel, had been snatched away from them for no reason at all, or for very perverse reasons. And
yes.
So, you know, you fast forward to this point in history, and you're just like, what? Obama, what? How that happened? But without King's life, you know, I don't think Obama would have been possible. I don't think I would have been possible. The fact that I have gained so much access in terms of education, in terms of political power, social power, cultural power, I think is very profound. And I think King made a way for so many people who were on the margins and whose voices were just dismissed to come to the forefront and have and evoke their own individual and also collective power. And so obviously we've made so many steps and strides in progress, but then you look at what's going on in the world right now. You look at the unemployment rate. Even in Memphis, the unemployment rate is double, particularly for black men, 17%. You know, this is what Dr. King was fighting against. Like, where are we in terms of economic equality? And I think that's actually one of the major issues in our presidential race right now. Like, how do we continue to grow the middle class? Who is even the middle class anymore? Like, what is the top 1%, and what is that 99%, and what is that fight? And the fact that the chasm between the 1% and the 99% continues to grow, get larger and larger and larger. And that is exactly what King died for. He did not let the sanitation workers sit alongside the Jericho Road. He went there and he spoke up for them, but who is speaking up for them now?
Right. And your same question to you, May.
In terms of citizenship? And
in terms of any progress. I mean, that was a horrible, horrible time in American history and world history. Mm-hmm. Did we move forward in any ways? Have we made substantial good change since then? Have we learned something?
I would agree with Katori. I mean, I think this point that she brings up and the issues that King brought to the forefront did make us a stronger citizenship. I have to say I'm depressed now about voter disenfranchisement that's happening in many of our swing states. And I feel like that's a step backwards, and it makes me wonder really how far we've gone if we have to fight this battle again. I mean, in Pennsylvania, Republican billionaire Richard Mellon had just published a story with the headline that the voter ID is required on November 6th, even though it was not. It is not. There is still so much propaganda that's out there discouraging people in Pennsylvania from voting. And these are American citizens. And these are the people that King and John Lewis and Andrew Young, they fought for their right to vote. And that without impediments. And so when I hear about these things, it's happening in Wisconsin, it's happening in Ohio, it's happening in Florida, I get very, very angry. And I feel like, where is our leadership in this, you know? And I know that there are lots of people trying to fight to keep those voter rights alive. But, you know, there's still work to do. There's still a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think we've gotten much further. I think that we have, you know, this country's come a long way in terms of race and dealing with race and having a conversation about race. And I think Katori's on to, you know, what King recognized was that the wealth disparity between the 1% and the 99% is actually what King was fighting for, and it's still a huge problem in this country.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them. Doris in Elm Grove. Hi, Doris.
Hello. I'm a longtime subscriber to the Rep and since the 60s, and this is one of the most powerful plays I've seen, and they're all wonderful plays. By the end of this play, I was just had tears coming down my. I was trying to, you know, repress my emotion, and I just like after a while didn't care anymore. I just bawled. I thought that when the curtain came down at the end and you saw what all happened since then, it just kind of culminated in such intensity. And I had read the article in the New Yorker as well, which explained it. And the Rep in Depth always explains everything about the author, and they just do a wonderful job. And this was, you know, I think of The Crucible. That was a good, really good play, but this was way up there. And very powerful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks, Doris. I like that New Yorker article, too, Katori. That was more than just an article. You went down to Memphis and... with the author of the article, it was good background, thorough background for seeing the play, don't you think? Did you like it?
I really loved it. And Michael Shulman, he's a wonderful reporter, and was very thorough and really was so respectful of my mother and just very sensitive to the fact that it was one of her biggest regrets. But she just, in a weird way, she just opened up and she was like, oh, when is Michael coming back to Memphis? she's a really amazing, effervescent person. And you'll actually see my mother in the play. Like, Hamay is definitely, you know, my mom in terms of tone. But obviously it kind of goes away from my mom towards the middle of the play. But, yeah, she really felt like it really captured her and her struggle as a 15-year-old when she couldn't go and hear him speak.
Your mama has a lot of spirit, doesn't she?
She does.
Yes, she does. Doris, thanks very much for your call. Deborah in New Berlin. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I first want to echo what Doris from Elm Grove said about the value of going to the Rep in Depth. We always go to the Rep in Depth, and it just gives such a great background of what you're going to see, staging and characters and whatever. So I encourage anybody who's going to the play to go 45 minutes prior to the curtain time, because that's really worth your time. But my question is, I know Dr. King belongs to everyone, but I personally was surprised to see very, very few African-American people in the audience. And from where I was sitting, I could see just a couple, and two of them, it was two women, they left during the play. And I'm hoping that there was, like, some other reason that they left. But have you gotten any feedback from, like, the Milwaukee African-American community if anybody was offended by the content of putting Dr. King in a real human character?
May?
I haven't. I haven't. You know, heard any of that kind of feedback.
Thanks, Deborah, for the call. I was concerned, and maybe this is a concern that's not just for theater, it's for symphony and all kinds of things, that there were not a lot of young people in the audience. Most people were about my age and were alive during that time. What can you do, and what have you done? And maybe it was different on Broadway, Katori, you had younger audiences. How do you reach out to those people? Katori?
Oh, I think it really has a lot to do with marketing and what that arm of the production is capable of doing. And it also has a lot to do with, has that audience already been developed at this particular theater? You know, me not knowing very much about the theater and the audiences, you know, I would know that. But I think, you know, also with Broadway, you just have more money for your marketing. That's just, you know, what it is. But I actually feel as though it's very important to have a very diverse audience for this play, because it's almost a call and response type of play. And I feel like a young audience, they are a little bit more relaxed. And I totally understand an audience member who actually probably walked with King, why they might be offended by the kind of vulnerability or kind of the lasciviousness that can sometimes be expressed in the lines. But I think with a younger audience, once again, you have that historical distance, and they kind of are looking at the play with open arms, coming to it wanting to learn something about themselves, and also to have their interest piqued in Dr. King. I actually feel as though people of my generation, we know about Dr. King in the history book, but we don't go deeper. And there's a lot of scholarship out there about him, and also about his private life. So I feel as though it allows people to go read And the Walls Came Tumbling Down and Taylor Branch's trilogy to really find out more about this man who transformed America.
Right. I know you do a lot of outreach, May, with schools in this area. Have you been able to perform The Mountaintop for high school students, for young people?
Yeah, you know, the Mark Clements, the artistic director, he knows that he really wants to open the doors at the Rep, and he is you know, working on initiatives to really diversify that audience. And they did add a couple of student matinees. They've been packed, and they have talkbacks afterwards. And I think it's a step forward in terms of diversifying for the theater, in terms of diversifying the audience. And from what I hear from the actors, you know, I'm in New York right now, but they are so galvanized and excited when the students come in, because it's a very different energy. And they listen to the play differently, and they miss a lot of the period jokes. but they get so much out of it.
Mm-hmm. And you've had it performed in England, Katori, and on Broadway, and now in Milwaukee. Is there a substantial difference in the audience reaction across the pond?
I am so surprised, but no.
Oh.
And my producers were very surprised, because Londoners tend to be a little repressed when they go to see plays. Mm-hmm. They don't clap, they don't laugh, they don't stand up.
Oh.
But at this play, they did it.
Oh.
And my producers could not get it. They were like, this is just outside of the box in terms of how our audiences are used to responding to plays. And I just think that it has this very deep emotional resonance. I also felt as though, because for the first time on the West End, they were really able to get a really diverse audience. The black audience members teach the white audience members how to respond to the play, and vice versa, just because I feel as though in the black community, there is a more outward expression, whether you like something or not. Like, you go, mm-hmm, if you hear something in recognition. And so this kind of opening up vocally in the audience, I think, allowed for a different experience in the play. But I was very surprised that I saw that in London as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let's go to Steve next in Delavan. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
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 I saw the play. I liked it very much. I liked the way you stage it. He felt so human to the audience. I mean, it was almost like you could smell his sweat, and He just seemed so human. And I, what I liked about the play was presenting it that way is oftentimes when we look at people who are prominent in the world, we find out that they're human and that they have feet of clay, and we use that as an excuse to discount what they did and their accomplishments. Mm. And I thought the way the play was written and the way it was presented did a very good job of getting around that.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Amos in Sauk County. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I want to make a comment, and then I would like to ask the playwright a question. I feel like I'm an old fogey. I was just talking with my wife about fictional biographies the other day, and saying I just couldn't understand how people could take real people and write about them in a fictional sense and not feel that they were stepping way out of bounds in terms of respect for an actual person. And, you know, I can understand how you get such a strong reaction from a lot of people, because what you're doing, you know, if you want to write something emotional with a play that does that, I mean, that's what wonderful fiction does. Well, you're taking a real person and you're inventing things about them. And if that isn't a sign of disrespect, I don't know what is.
Have you seen the play? But Amos, have you seen the play?
No.
Okay.
I know, I understand from listening to this whole program what it's about, which is somebody taking a real-life person and manipulating what they are about so that you can be, you know, get a play that's on stage. Mm-hmm. And what if I were to decide I'm going to take the playwright, and I know her, and I'm going to take her name, and I'm going to make a play, and I'm going to invent some reality about her, and I'm going to go out and promote this, and people that know her in the neighborhood are going to come out and watch this play. Would she feel comfortable with me doing that to her?
Okay, Amos. Well, this is a thought-provoking comment.
Is that your question, sir?
Yeah, well, just your response to his comments here, that it's disrespectful to take somebody who was a real human being and put words in his mouth and motives for behavior, et cetera. It's disrespectful.
Well, I think it's very hard for me to respond to the comment of a person who actually hasn't seen the fight or experienced it.
Right.
And I feel as though, obviously, we're all going to make assumptions based on, you know, hearsay or what we're imagining the play is about. However, while I understand your discomfort, you have to realize that as a playwright, you know, I have the freedom of imagination. I have freedom of speech. And the fact is, I actually took a lot of real things and interwove them into the play in a very heightened way. You may think that I'm fictionalizing it, but the play actually steps into the realm of spirituality and magical realism. It actually takes different techniques of theater making to get at an emotional truth. So it's hard for me to respond to someone who just hasn't experienced it. I would feel more comfortable, you know, if the person actually was open enough to go on that journey with the play and with the characters that have been created that are based on real events. For example, in the play, Kame and Dr. King have a pillow fight. Andrew Young and Ralph Abernathy actually had a pillow fight with Dr. King 2 hours before he was killed.
Really?
Like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Ambassador Young about this pillow fight, and Ambassador Young read the play, and he was like, that's true. That's true. He was able to look at the script and say, oh, that was true, and you wove it in this way, in an imaginative way. So while I understand your response, you know, I get it. I respect your opinion, and you know, I respect you as a human being. I, quite frankly, if someone wanted to do a play about me, I would say, go ahead. It's imagination. It's a playground. Plays are play. It's about us playing and getting at an emotional truth.
Yeah. And without giving away the plot, which I don't want to do because I want people to have the experience of seeing this for the first time, but what you do with the play adds another whole element to the conversation that we can't really talk about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why it's hard for me to
Right. Thanks, Amos. And you can't say that. Think of all the literature, the good literature. Think of what Gore Vidal did with Abraham Lincoln and with others, Aaron Burr, and that historical fiction can be highly interesting and also very ripe for great playwrights and great authors. And you can't just say you can't ever do that. People do it all the time, and some of it is terrific literature.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I personally think it allows history to have an emotional lens that it doesn't necessarily have in books that are just like, this happened, then this happened, then that happened, and he did that. It allows us to like get inside someone's heart and walk in their shoes in a way that I don't think just regular nonfiction can.
We welcome more phone calls. We're talking about The Mountaintop, which is currently at the Stemke Theater, Milwaukee rep production of this play. It ran recently on Broadway, and it has been much written about and talked about simply because of what it's about. It takes place in the Lorraine Motel, the room where Dr. Martin Luther King was after he gave that haunting and absolutely beautiful and important Mountaintop speech, and it's the eve of his assassination. Two-person play. The author of the play, Katori Hall, a playwright, performer, author of The Mountaintop, and she's going to see the Milwaukee performance next week, she said. May Adrales is artistic associate at the Milwaukee Rep and director of The Mountaintop. Here is our phone number. Join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org, or Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Jerry Ann in South Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I saw the play about a week and a half ago, and it was stupendous as far as I'm concerned. I was alive when Dr. King was assassinated. I was an adult. And I have been to the Lorraine Motel and stood on the balcony on the very spot that Dr. King was standing on when he was assassinated. Mm-hmm. That and this play are giant steps for me in what I feel was an epiphany that occurred many years ago about what Dr. King and the civil rights movement was all about. I grew up in the South. I was indoctrinated against many things, including the many flaws of Dr. King, and they, of course, were highlighted in my, quote, social education. And seeing this play, to me, put those flaws into wonderful context. Mm. Yes, he was human, but we all are. And someone made the remark about his fighting for voting rights of African Americans. Yes, that was the focus, but I think he was fighting for voting rights of all Americans, not mm-hmm. not just yeah. one segment. At least I think that's how it turned out. And I am extremely distressed at what I see as the repression of voting rights of what I think are primarily the category of minorities, African Americans and so forth, and truly the rights of all people. I saw a sign not long ago of someone protesting the, quote, war against women, saying, I can't believe we're having to fight for this bleep after all these years, and I feel that's what's going on with voting rights.
Katori. Katori, you want to respond?
No, I mean, I too agree with just feeling so distressed. You know, my father, you know, he votes for everything. And, you know, he will go vote for the school board, you know, at the school board election, because he just knows what we have gone through. And I think it is, he gets very irritated when he sees the lies about, oh, you got to bring this card in order to vote and whatnot. And so I too, this feeling of constant, I just feel distressed. And I oftentimes joke, and maybe it's going to turn into reality, that I'm actually going to move to Africa if things don't get better. Not to say that it's better over there, but I'm just so, unfortunately, I'm not proud of America at times. It's kind of similar to that Michelle Obama quote that she got a lot of flack for when Obama was being
was trying to get elected that first time. I'm like, this is the first time that I'm proud of America when all that was happening. But now I just feel as though a lot of people, and you know, I can speak specifically about me and many members of the African-American community, we just feel like we're going backwards in time.
Katori, thank you so much for writing such a play. Everybody wants to talk about it. And May, thank you for staging it and interpreting it so beautifully. I think that you probably are anxious to have Katori come and see it because you've done a lovely job with it.
Oh, I'm excited.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I'll bet. Thank you both very much.
Thank
for
you,
being
May.
With us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katori, for writing a beautiful play.
Thanks to everybody. Katori Hall, playwright, performer, and author of The Mountaintop. It is now on stage at the Milwaukee Rep, and it continues through the 4th of November. May Adrales, artistic associate at the Milwaukee Rep and director of The Mountaintop. We end with some of the music that you hear as you enter the theater, which gets you in the mood for the play. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this hour. Thanks for your calls. We'll be with you tomorrow. No time coming, but I know